make all of the outcomes plausible. Some things the wire made up. Some things absolutely happened. Some things we always heard they happened, but they were part of cop stories or what people said somebody did or why somebody got killed. But it couldn't violate the basic tenet of this is the world. This is how it works. This is a logical and rational outcome of this.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
You're trying to say there's a truth here, and you have to see it. These characters are not the everyday world of the inner city because the everyday world within the inner city, you wouldn't want to watch that show. It just goes on. It's relentless. I always think of it in terms of human drama, with the emphasis on the human. You're staying true to the characters, and you're just trying to share what they're going through. They're all composites, but there's an integrity to them that flows. There's no miracles happening. They're on this course, and tragically enough, very little can steer those kids, those people, away from that particular course that they've started out. You don't get a story unless there's a back and forth. David and I provided the wind, and guys like George Pelicanos and Bob Colesbury, if we went off too much in one direction, they would turn the ship back, get closer to reality again. It's like a hop, skip, and a jump. Next thing you know, you're way over here, and you don't want to be over here. Yes, we argued all the time. I would say there's two-thirds argue.
David Simon, creator.
The argument was creative, and if somebody stops arguing, it's because they don't give a fuck. Ed gave a fuck, and I expected him to argue, and I expected him to be frustrated, and I learned it is not always pleasant. We probably finished 4 to 5 seasons with Ed feeling like we left stuff on the table that we couldn't get to. Ed is a guy who, if you present him with a scenario like, we're going to have a story arc that goes here, he'll come up with enough material for 35 episodes. Then it's up to the practical choices of what we can get to and what's best. What would be the best choices here? Even when you make those choices, you're leaving 30 elements behind, because that's how fast and how thoroughly Ed turns a Rubik's Cube. If we do this, then we can speak to that. He does all that. Ed would always finish the seasons incredibly frustrated. He'd be like, we blew it. We could have done this. Like, yeah, well, we did what we did, Ed. We opened some doors, we closed some other ones. He would go, what's the point? He would go into the hibernation of being off for a month, completely disgusted with the whole process, and then by the end, the episodes would come out, not that he was sanguine about everything, but he would come back ready to work the next season. He needed the month off just to take a breath. Everybody in the room would be in agreement. Okay, this is what we're doing. Ed would come back the next day and say, it's not right. Then he would proceed with the argument. Sometimes he would turn us all around, and sometimes we would just have to go, Ed, we can't. We don't have the characters. We don't have the locations. There's no sensibility in the story that that would happen. We've traveled 1,000,000 miles to get to some point that we can't justify turning to. Other times, he would turn the whole ship around. He'd be like, I agreed to this, but you know what? Think about this. Because 2 or 3 episodes from now, or next year, what you will have effectively said is X when you needed to say Y. We'd all sit there going like, shit. We just wasted a day yesterday. We're back to square one. That's Ed. By the way, that's the core DNA of what made The Wire what it was Ed arguing.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
David would get very, very frustrated because I would come in after the beat sheet was all done and the writer was off writing. I'd come in and say, we've got to change this. This works better. It would drive him crazy, but he'd change it. David handled everything. That left me free to handle just story, and that's all I was interested in. He would do posts, and he would deal with HBO and deal with the actors. I could just be free to do story.
David Simon, creator.
George is the barometer. When the morality of the show or the ethos of the show, when it's going wrong or when we're not honoring something or a character, that's where he'll assert himself in a way that can change the direction of the storyline or story arc. Once the universe is established, if we're getting too schmaltzy, he's on it. If we're being brutal just to be brutal, he's on it. I've learned to listen to him. Ed and I could argue for hours, and George would be the third guy who would spin it one way or the other. George was the third vote. If you swayed George, then you were probably right. If you didn't sway George, it was time to rethink.
George Pelicanos, writer and producer.
Not in the sense that I went one way or the other. The one argument was about the chips and the phones. That went on for a week with the SIM cards. Guys, can we move on? Like, this is ridiculous, you know? Let's get some cards up on the board. That was my role, was to be sort of the adult and say, it's time to stop arguing. Let's just move on because we've got to get some work done. There's that expression David always uses it. I'd agree with you, but then we'd both be wrong. He never will give up a fight, and Ed's like that too, even when they're wrong.
David Simon, creator.
I didn't get everything I wanted in the scripts. I lost arguments to Ed. Ed lost arguments to me. Ed doesn't like to lose arguments. He's pretty unrelenting. It becomes sort of a hive mentality if it works. If it doesn't work, then you don't have a writer's room. If it becomes just one person, you can't imagine the universe well enough. You can't imagine all these different characters well enough to have it have the breath that it needs to have. You gotta let air into the room. You have to argue. The room has to be about argument. It has to be good academic arguing. It can get a little heated. You're basically arguing a story. You're not arguing self-validation. These are writers. They're novelists by training. George is a novelist. George sits down, and it's him and the paper, maybe an editor behind him, and that's it. That's the only thing between him and broadcast and publication. This is not that. What I'm saying is writers are about ego. What else has a greater vanity than coming to a sort of collective campfire and saying, I have a story I want to tell. My story is good. Pay attention to me. This is my story. I've got a great story. My story is better. The whole act of telling a story is a grandiose thing in some ways. So now you get a bunch of storytellers in the room, and they have to get along. They have to create one singular thing. It's at a point the showrunner has to be a little bit totalitarian and say, I have to look out for the whole. But long before I do that, you need to be open enough and benign enough to let the arguments lead you where they're going to lead you. Those were the moments that made The Wire better than it might have been.
The casting of several new starring members stretched casting directors Alexa L. Fogel and Pat Moran. Chris Bauer had previously auditioned for McNulty. James Ranzone was a young, talented Baltimore actor, more than capable of pulling off a Baltimore drawl. And Pablo Schreiber left an original, indelible mark after his reading. Pablo Schreiber, Nick Sabatka.
The second season was a huge baby of Robert Colesbury. He was one of the main producers on the show. He was in the room with David when I had my callback. I guess part of the reason he liked me so much is when I came for my callback, there was an assistant of the casting director, Alexa Fogel. Alexa had this casting assistant at the time, and her name was Jennifer LaFleur. She's actually an actress now, and it's funny. I flirted with her outside of the audition before I went in, and after I finished the audition. I left, and I called the casting office after I had left, and I asked for Jennifer. And they put her on the phone, and I asked her on a date. She said no, because she had a boyfriend. And I guess she obviously told Alexa that this had happened. And when Robert Colesbury found out that I had done this, called the casting office to ask this girl on a date, he was very taken with my ballsiness or something.
Chris Bauer, Frank Sabatka.
I had watched the first season and was scared shitless by its authenticity and patience. If you bullshitted for 1 second in that aesthetic, you'd stand out like a dirty diaper. I didn't audition. They very generously trusted me enough to offer the part. I did, however, audition for McNulty while they were casting the pilot. Imagine a bloated, hungover, mumbling McNulty who looked like he'd be single for his whole life. Frank Sabatka was a much better fit.
James P.J. Ranson, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
My friend Leo Fitzpatrick was on the first season, and he was Johnny, Bubbles' junkie pal. We sort of knew each other from New York. I would see posters for The Wire on the train, and I'd be like, oh, that's that show that Leo is going to do. You have to remember, no one cared about that show until the fourth season. No one watched it. I was 21 or 22, and it was probably my third legit job and definitely the biggest. It was the most corporate gig I've had up until then. I was just really young.
Amy Ryan, Officer Beatrice Beatty Russell.
I was a huge fan of the show. I went to high school with Seth Gilliam. We were good friends, and so that was a cool moment, that first scene we filmed together in Daniels' office. And every time they block us next to each other, we just crack up. When I am a fan of something, I turn to mush when I get there. I'd watched the whole first season, and I remember when I was on the show, we were working on this soundstage the second season of the show. I saw the orange couch stored up in the rafters, and it literally took my breath away. Oh my God, the couch, the couch!
Al Brown, Major Stan Velchek.
I was astounded when they got in touch with me when it was time to start thinking about the second season. As an actor, I hadn't missed church for a whole bunch of weeks. As far as I knew, I was a day player, one shot, and I was done. And suddenly, a year after that, pretty much that season was largely about me and another Picayune argument because I was only pissed at Frank Sabatka because the priest put his stained glass window in the right part of the church and I ended up in the basement. I was trying to be teacher's pet and Sabatka beat my ass to it. That's about what it boiled down to.
Chris Bauer, Frank Sabatka.
I loved Al and was obsessed with his accent. A very nice guy. I thought, there's no way that guy could be an actor. He's gotta be the real thing. It was as if they went and handed some commander at the nearest precinct a couple pages and told him, go. He is one of those Peter Lorre types who just stands there and talks and the audience is transfixed. There were a lot of those bastards on The Wire. Naturals.
Pablo Schreiber, Nick Sabatka.
What was interesting was feeling the vibe of the guys who had been there in the first season and a lot of that, like, who the fuck are these new guys and why is he writing stuff for them all of a sudden? And then when it came out, I think people who had watched it kind of religiously, a lot of people were kind of taken aback because it was obviously the first time the show had shifted and changed like that, and a lot of people expected it to stay the same. So a lot of people were sort of taken aback and frustrated by the shift. Then there was a whole other sort of people at the time who discovered the show for the first time with that season. And then they had to go back and watch the first season. For that whole group of people who were watching at the time and discovering the show, it wasn't as disorienting or off-putting. But yeah, it was interesting. Great actors like Andre Royo and Wood Harris, some of the characters that weren't getting written for the second season, they were like, what's going on? Why are they writing for these guys? What's happening? But obviously, everything, in retrospect, makes a lot of sense in looking at the canvas he created.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
After season one, we weren't a popular show, but it was a popular show in our hoods. When everybody would go back to their neighborhood, they were the street stars. We're telling a story about us, and we're doing it in a way that's being looked at as really, really good. People are loving that they can relate to it. It's dope. We're feeling good. And not for nothing, this is the first time you're getting paid per episode. Most of us weren't at that contract where you get paid no matter what. At that point, You gotta do an episode to get paid. You get a call from David Simon or Nina, and they go, for season two, HBO is not gonna let us have series regulars on contract. We gotta release your contract, and we're bringing in this new story. We're telling a storyline from a different perspective. The businessman in you is stuck and pissed off. I got a contract, and now you're telling me my contract is null and void? What's that about? It is what it is. This is what the deal was. They told me, this is what's going to happen. We're going to release your contract. We promise you in season three, you'll have all shows produced where you'll get paid, whether you do an episode or not. I need you not to fight season two. We're going to cut your contract and renew your contract. My manager at the time, she was serious. She's like, this is a business. This is how they do. She told me not to come back. She said, what we're going to do, you're going to say no. You're going to do two, but you're not coming back for season three. You're done with this show. I was like, word? Is that the move we want to make? She was like, yeah. Guess what, Dre? You did season one, and you weren't supposed to be one of the standouts, but people know you now from that season. She talked to me about the things I was scared of. She was like, you don't want to be typecast. If you stay in the show too long, that might happen. Two, you see these people, they do whatever they want with the contract. They can say the contract is good. No, they're trying to fuck you. This is how the business is. I want to protect you. Don't go back. I was like, okay, where am I going? What show am I going on next? She was like, we don't know. But the only way you're going to find out is you got to believe in me. And you got to not go back. I was like, oh, shit. All right. Then I'm looking at a daughter with her shoes that were too tight who needs new shoes. I'm looking at my life like, I can't. I got to go back. I think the show is too important. If David Simon said they'll bring us back season three, then I gotta believe him. She's like, okay, I doubt it. She started making phone calls. She started becoming a pest to the point where Nina Noble had to call me and go, listen, did David Simon tell you about what's going on with season two and how we're going to bring you back in season three? I was like, yeah. Do you believe David Simon? I'm like, yeah. Well, then you got to tell your manager to stop calling us. We're not going to deal with the manager. And if we got to deal with the manager, then we can just release you right now. If he gave you his word, you got to trust him. It put me in a position where I had to fire my manager. I had to be like, you can't call this guy. I know you're fighting for me, but I told you I'm gonna do it. We believe these people. She was like, I get it, Trey. I know I crossed the line. I just want to let you know that's how the business is. Just be careful. I loved my manager. She's the one who believed in me and got the ball rolling when I first started doing the theater to television. I was a little nervous. I remember walking on set a little grumpy. I had a little attitude. I talked to David Simon and I asked the question, what's this season about? He has some interesting things to say. His point of view, which I believe to be correct, he was like, listen, I cannot tell a drug story. I cannot tell a story about the drug game and it be all about black people. That's wrong. I feed into the stupid lying stereotype that the industry has been doing for years, in that drugs is a black problem. It's not. It's not. I need to tell this angle because white people are involved in this shit too. This is not a race problem. It's a human problem. I don't want this show to look at it and just be a drug game and a violence game and it be all black people. I agreed with that, but it took me a minute.
Michael K. Williams, Omar Little.
Season two. I was so ignorant to the game with David, his sophisticated style of writing, and his take, which is why he even got into show business in the first place. It wasn't to be some Hollywood writer. He had a message to get out there. I was clueless to all of that. When he brought all the white actors in to tell the Doc story, I was very ignorant. Long story short, I got very ignorant and bitter.
David Simon, creator.
Andre was furious. I tried to explain it. The guy who I explained it to and who started to get it, I had a conversation with Michael Kay. I said, if we just stay focused on the Barksdales, we don't move the story around. We don't change the prism. We're a much smaller show. We will not be about what we're going to be about. I said, this is the moment where we say we'll do anything. This is where we claim the whole city for our own. It's not that the characters are white. It's that the characters were at the point of importation of the drugs and the death of the working class. The union that you're going to see under pressure is going to be multiracial. There's going to be black stevedores. But it is important that it have a white presence because the last thing I want to do is suggest that you can track the drug problem through America by following black people. That's a very reductive thing that I'm not going to say. I'm going to say that you can track the drug problem into America by following class and that, in a very fundamental way, the working class, white and black, is being devoured, and the underclass is growing because of the industrialization. I said, if we don't suggest that the morality is permeable to all races at this point, we're saying some ugly shit that I don't believe in and we have no right to say. I want to see Nikki Sabatka become a drug dealer like the guys I knew down in Pigtown, whose dads were stevedores, and then they were on the fucking corner. I sort of said, we're not forgetting you. We're not walking away from anything. But it was really hard. We never thought of it as a black show. We were doing Baltimore. So I would say that to them, and they would be like, but we did. We thought we had this. They had the Sopranos, we had this, and now you're fucking it up. I was like, I'm not thinking about it like that.
Lance Riddick, Lieutenant Cedric Daniels.
The race part of it was almost tangential. I feel like the more conscious attempts that The Wire made in making people look at that was in terms of class.
Glenn Turman, Mayor Clarence V. Royce.
I've got to admit that it crept up on me slowly while doing the show. I didn't watch the show a great deal before I got on the show. I had friends telling me about it. I tune in every once in a while, but once I got on the show is when I started reading the scripts that came through and found out that I was reading more than just my part, that I was reading the whole script. You get a script, and you just want to read your role. But I would read it because it was like reading a book. And I realized somewhere during the course, I said, God, over half the characters in this piece are black. And it dawned on me. And the major thing was, I never got a sense that it was a quote-unquote black show. But the question was, how did it happen? How is it that it doesn't feel like a black show, and that over half of the characters are black, and that it's a show that takes place in the hood, on the corners, and it still doesn't come across as a black show? What is that all about? And it's because all of the characters were so multidimensional and non-stereotypical, and that the show never spoke down to its audience, no matter what level you were dealing with in the structure of society that the characters dwelled in. Everyone was bright, and everyone had a point of view, and everyone had a dimension that was a human quality, no matter how steeped in chaos and mire that they were.
Pablo Schreiber, Nick Sabatka.
People get really comfortable with the characters in that first season, and then all of a sudden they were forced to develop relationships with a whole new cast of characters. I think it really tested people's patience, and everybody has their own vision of what the show should be.
David Simon, creator.
I certainly think the show had a ceiling built in because the majority of the cast was African American. Okay, race has got to be a part of any show. If you're writing about America, if you're trying to make a critique about urban America, you have to make sure that you acknowledge that. But I didn't even think we were really writing about race, if that makes sense. We scheduled a cast in Baltimore that we knew. We accepted the city on the terms that we knew. I live in Baltimore. I still live in Baltimore. We made the police department the racial breakdown of the department that we have. In City Hall, we structured it like it is, We just took it as a given. Nobody woke up in the morning and said, oh, we're going to make a black show. That's all just a form of ghettoization itself. I'm going to make a black show. Fuck that. We are making a show about Baltimore, but we didn't pull the punch and go, oh man, we need to have 60% white people or we're going to lose a white audience. I think I always assumed that we would lose audience, and in a weird way, the HBO model allowed a new show like this to survive without degrading it. It was a luxury. If we were chasing advertising dollars and tried to maximize the audience, the show does not survive. But HBO brought people into the tent to watch it for what it was. It didn't bring everybody into the tent. More people came for The Sopranos. But as long as we added to the amount of people who subscribed or helped, we could be part of this little family and they'd leave us alone.
Seth Gilliam, Sergeant Ellis Carver.
David Simon told us at one point, you know that frustration you're feeling as actors is a frustration that Herc and Carver are feeling as cops, so you can use that.
David Simon, creator.
He was like, fuck you, I'm upset. Use the frustration. Fuck you. But then they get pushed into the Western District, and both characters have this arc. And that was the thing about certain seasons. Some people are going to come into the fore and be more active, and some of them are not. And if you tried to service everyone in the same way, then you would end up with five separate narratives that are the same. Not every tool for every job.
Seth Gilliam, Sergeant Ellis Carver.
I'd asked him about it at one point, and he had mentioned that. And he was kind of smiling as he said it, like, you'll understand when it all comes together.
Dominic Lombardozzi, Detective Thomas Herc Hauck.
The second season, we probably were a little frustrated because we were kind of reduced to second unit. We were just doing a lot of surveillance stuff. I was never really upset at that kind of stuff. I just wish Herc would turn into another type of guy or go down a different kind of path. Maybe not always be this rough guy. That kind of stuff, because after a while, that sits with you. You go to work. Okay, what am I doing? Okay, I'm beating up Bodie again. When you sit back and you think about it, it's genius because it's part of David's genius. He never jumped the shark. Everything was true. Everything was solid. Everything was where it was supposed to be. People, they do not change. That's reality. What you want and what happens in reality are two different things. As an actor, I don't know any actor that doesn't get frustrated. You play a character long enough, sometimes you're going to see things differently, but second season was only because we were reduced to a second unit. In retrospect, I'm kind of glad we were because we got to work with Bob Colesberry a lot. I learned a lot from Bob. I wouldn't trade the second season and what I had to do and all that time I spent with Bob for anything. He was the eyes of the show. David was the ears of the show. A lot of that vision, that's all Bob Colesberry.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
We didn't see David Simon after the first season. He was in the room, the think tank. Ed Burns, you saw every once in a while. He'll come to set, but you didn't really talk to him because he was scary. He just didn't talk. When he talked, you felt like an idiot. Bob Colesberry was our producer that was a go-to between the actors and everybody. Colesberry was a good mixture of both. He was like, I'm smart like these motherfuckers, but I'm cool and personable. I could hang out with the actors. I could tell you the football scores without making you feel bad. He was this guy producing Mississippi Burning. He understood good storytelling. He was a cool dude.
Pablo Schreiber, Nick Sabatka.
First day, I slept through my alarm. I guess what happened was, it was the early days of cell phones. I set my cell phone as an alarm, and then the battery ran out overnight. I woke up to being like an hour and a half past my call time, jumped out of bed, got in the car, sped down there as quick as I could, and ended up getting stopped on the way, and got a speeding ticket, and ended up showing up to set 2.5 hours after my call time for my first day of shooting. PJ Ransone and I were kind of the new additions to the season, so we hadn't been there. and that was the first impression I was making, was showing up 2.5 hours late. They were all obviously upset and disappointed. I was petrified. I thought for sure I was going to shoot the day and be asked to leave the following. But they were very gracious in saying, just focus on your work and get the best work done you can, and don't worry about this. And yeah, I don't remember the next time I was late the whole season.
Chris Bauer, Frank Sabatka.
I have a vivid and uncomfortable memory of my reaction to finding the dead girls in a can on the harbor front at the end of the first episode of season 2. As the scene unfolded, Ed Bianchi, the great director, blocked the shot so that as the door opened to reveal the dead bodies, I was in position to express shock, dismay, and panic, a great, oh shit, moment. The first couple takes I overacted so much he had to pull me aside, and if I remember his exact words, they were, what the fuck are you doing? That was the last time I tried to show anyone how good I was.
Ed Bianchi, director.
A big problem with the beginning of that season was establishing the yard where the cans were and the set we were shooting on. We weren't actually shooting on the set where the cans were. We were shooting on a parking lot right next to it, where we had our own cans but a limited amount of them. We had to shoot half the scene in one place, and then, for the reverse, we were allowed to go on the real yard where the boxes were coming in and shot that on another day. That was an interesting thing that we worked out between Bob and I. It really made you feel like you were in the real place as opposed to being on a set.
Amy Ryan, Officer Beatrice Beatty Russell.
We have these amazing women, these extras, playing the dead women. They weren't dummy bodies. They were real people huddled up on top of each other, and it was scary. I only had gone through it once. The camera person knew where I was going, but I think that was such an extraordinary scene. It's so chilling because it happens. It's not just like Hollywood make-believe. I'm sure that happens more often than we really know about, and I just found it scary, like a horror movie.
Paul Ben Victor, Spiros Vondis Vondopoulos.
I think it was the first episode when I had to slit that guy's throat. Bill Raymond and I had never worked together. We actually became friends and ended up doing some other things together. I remember that first scene. We dragged a guy in. He's tied up in the chair, and when I do slit his throat, we had this whole blood rig that was geared up to his throat so it would get nice and bloody. The first time we did it, when we rehearsed it, in the moment the actor was playing the victim there, he really got into it. When I grabbed him, he really struggled from me and got out of my hand. We lost our rhythm and the blood went everywhere and it didn't really work, so we had to do that twice, having to clean him all up, get everything all rigged up again.
Debbie Young, makeup department head.
The engineer guy that was naked, he had his throat slit by one of the Greeks. Bob Colesbury, he came over to me. He said, Debbie, in this episode, I want when his throat is slit for him to bleed on camera. I'm like, okay. He said, well, he's going to be naked. I'm like, okay. Sandy and I start thinking about it. We don't have anywhere to hide anything. We had to do all that. We first worked out how we were going to get the blood to come out of the pump. Then we just had to figure out how we were going to do it. We were in an old warehouse. We took surgical tubing, and we had blood that will pump through the tubing that we were hiding our contraption under, an old, dirty staircase in this warehouse. We had the tube run across the floor, and then we take the tube up the back of the metal legs of the chair. Again, he's sitting there naked, a costume, of course, covering his private parts. We had beat him up in the trailer, got his face all bruised up and cut. When we got out there, we had to bring that tubing across the floor of the warehouse to the chair, tape the tubing up the chair. We taped it up to behind the seat and taped it up his back. Then we brought the tubing up under his left arm and had the tubing open up into his palm. We told him, once he has pulled that knife across your throat, bring your hands up to your throat. And that's when we started to pump. The blood just oozed out through his fingers.
Amy Ryan, Officer Beatrice Beatty Russell.
When we were shooting, we were inside the warehouse in the containers. It was January in Baltimore, and however cold it was outside in the water, it was even colder inside because everything's just metal, like being in a big refrigerator. I was in layers and layers of silk and long johns underneath. They put the whole gun belt gadget stuff on me, and even with all those extra layers of clothing, it pulled. I started to have plumber's crack. They pulled it out and gave me a plastic gun. It doesn't make you feel very tough for a standard officer, but Beatty Russell was never really that tough.
Chris Bauer, Frank Sabatka.
By the end of the first episode I shot, I never thought for one second about performance, because my faith in the authorship was blind. Those words did all the work. Even a casual familiarity with text analysis yielded a strong sense of theme, and especially regarding Frank Sabatka, an Aristotelian batch of hubris that would ultimately take a character down.
James P.J. Ransom, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
The first scene that I auditioned for was the bar scene in episode 201. A lot of the dialogue is so dense, and I was talking about all these characters that I had no idea about. The dialogue was really dense. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just like, oh, I can do a Baltimore accent.
Norman Noerline, researcher.
The whole Ziggy character came literally from stories from Walt Benowitz. There's a guy named Pinky. He was a complete oddball, but because he was related to the head of the union, he was able to get through. He would wear a suit to the bar in the afternoon. He at one point had a duck. This is completely true. He had a duck with a diamond collar, and he would bring it into the bars. South Baltimore was checkers and union workers, and they worked in the Port of Baltimore. They lived in this really small neck of the woods where everybody knew everybody. Everybody was connected. Everybody drank in the neighborhood bars. You'd have these little shops. Sometimes people would have bars in their front rooms, and it was like a converted townhouse. Pinky would come in there with this duck with the diamond necklace, and he'd give it vodka. One time, they kept saying, "Get this duck out of here. Get this duck out of here." The duck drank too much vodka, fell off the bar, and died. The bartender's like, "You need to clean up this dead duck." He's like, "I don't know what you're talking about. That's not mine." Pinky left, and then he came back because the duck had this diamond necklace. Got the diamond necklace back, and then gave someone $50. Go bury that duck in the backyard.
Pablo Schreiber, Nick Sabatka.
I do remember having a great time with PJ in that scene where he comes out of the bar really drunk. It was after he had been in the bar with the duck that whole time, and I come and basically slap him around a little bit. I guess that probably sounds like most of the scenes we had together.
James P.J. Ransom, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
They gave me this penis prosthetic, and they brought it in my trailer. It was like the fucking size of my forearm. I was like, this thing's insane. This could kill a person. It was really translucent, so it looked like it had just come out of some factory mold. It looked really fake. I had to wear it on this big harness. Then we got to set, and I'd pull it out. And we had this German director of photography, a woman named Uta Briesewitz. I'd pull it out, and she'd go, "It's reading too light in the lens." Then these women, these really sweet middle-aged women who David Simon has worked with since Homicide, they would have to come over and shade in my fake penis as it's hanging out of my pants. They'd be like, "Oh, okay, I think that's a little darker." Then they'd pull it out again, and Uta would be like, "It's still too light in the lens." Then they'd have to come over and airbrush it. So it became this beautiful work of art.
Uta Briesewitz, cinematographer.
The collar just didn't match the person that was wearing it.
James P.J. Ransom, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
Then, after we shot it, I was like, "Hey, can I keep that thing? Just as like a souvenir, you know?" Because, can you imagine, I want the shark fin from Jaws? I was like, I want this huge fake cock, right? Maybe one day I'll show it to my kids, and then I'll be like, this is what people thought your old man was made of. But then they were like, no, you can't have it. They were like, what if we need it for reshoots? So it's literally hanging in a warehouse somewhere in case we were going to reshoot it.
Pablo Schreiber, Nick Sabatka.
That was funny. Obviously, if your character is written with a massive schlong, then you either have it or you don't. Well, you know, maybe PJ does, and he didn't want to show his own. Maybe he wanted to keep it for himself. Either way, the stand-in penis did a great job. Everybody was very happy with his work. Everybody was very complimentary to the penis afterward.
James P.J. Ransom, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
Chris Bauer really sort of was the first person to come along and make me really respect, I don't want to say my own talent, but my own sort of process or abilities. He created sort of like a nurturing space, so anytime that we really got to dig into anything, the work just became really interesting for me. I think we had a little bit more like a father and son thing because he had his shit together a lot more than I did when I was in my 20s. He sort of helped me through some really dark times in my life, but beyond that, he's been the first sort of shepherd that I've had in terms of being able to respect myself. Not myself, that's a lot, but to respect the artistry that I was trying to undertake. I don't know if I would have been able to do anything that I did on that show if it weren't for him specifically.
Pablo Schreiber, Nick Sabatka.
I would immediately lock myself in my room and read the whole script from front page to back because they were so involving and I was so into the story at that point. So when Zig kills the guy, I remember reading the part where he went back and sat in the car, and I remember reading it for the first time. I'm not really an emotional reader. Scripts don't usually affect me emotionally that much. But I remember actually crying a little bit when he went back to the car and I thought, oh, fuck, that's it for him. We're not going to see him anymore. And then, obviously, one of my first reactions was, well, shit, what's going to happen to Nick? How is this all going to play itself out? Am I not going to be involved in the show anymore?
James P.J. Ransom, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
Ernest Dickerson shot that episode, and we had sort of already gotten into our rhythm. We knew it was coming to a close, both the show and our storylines. A lot of times in TV, when they call for you to cry, you can use fake tears. I use them a lot still. I'm not too proud to say that I do. When we were shooting the jail scene, I was like, all right. I want to make this as authentic as possible. When Chris and I shot that jail scene, we had developed such a kinship. They shot my coverage of that first. They were like, all right, we're going to shoot your side. And then they were like, all right. Once we sort of have what we want to view, we'll come around and we'll get Chris Bauer's side. It's really tiring to cry that much. You've got to work yourself into a pretty dark state, and you have to stay there to make it conceivable. We're on Chris's side. I have the choice whether or not I just remove myself from that dark space and feel like I don't have to cry as much anymore. I was a pretty young dude, and I was like, fuck that. This dude has shown me gratitude and respect. I think there's a better performance of me that didn't get filmed because I was like, I want to give you the best version that I possibly can every time so you have something to react off of.
Chris Bauer, Frank Sabatka.
By the time we got to the jail scene, the weight of the story between us was so apparent, and the words so elegantly placed to avoid sentiment or indulging in emotional understanding beyond the character's own understanding, that the scene played itself. It's an utterly loving embrace of people at their most human, witnessing the dissolution of their best intentions in excruciating pain because there's nothing they can do to stop the collapse of their lives. And why is it my favorite scene? Besides how permissive and supportive the crew and director Ernest Dickerson were, it's a beautiful love scene. I think of it now and I get moist in the eyes. They were fucked. Look at the writing in that scene. Sabatka says to Ziggy, in a noble effort to rouse some fight and macho optimism, "You're a Sabatka." Ziggy answers, "Fucked is what I am." Gives me chills.
James P.J. Ranson, Chester Ziggy Sabatka.
He said that a lot more poetically than I did, that motherfucker.
Chris Bauer, Frank Sabatka.
I have a vague but treasured memory of walking with David Simon down the waterfront while he told me of a wonderful character's imminent demise. He said something like, "The audience doesn't get to decide who lives and dies. The story does." If only all writers in television felt the same.
Although The Wire's canvas expanded, the show consciously tended to the storylines of continuing characters while still introducing new figures, such as Robert Wisdom's Major Bunny Colvin and Method Man's Cheese Wagstaff, who would play larger roles in future seasons. Melanie Nichols King, Cheryl.
I got pregnant in between first season and second season shooting. I was concerned. I was like, uh-oh, I don't know where they're going with this. I don't know what their plans are for this character. Not to say that lesbians don't have children. I didn't know where the writers were planning to go with it. I was worried that it would be a detriment to me being able to continue to play this character. Then I got the first script to season two, and it said our first scene together was Kima and Cheryl are investigating in vitro fertilizing. I was like, oh my God, that is total universe. Thank you. That's what would be going on. I was able to tell the writers. It was funny because I was still kind of worried because they hadn't made a clear decision about who was going to actually carry the child. Because Kima is really a character, I assumed that they would probably have her go through that journey. I actually didn't tell them the first episode that I went down to Baltimore to shoot. I didn't tell them that I was pregnant. And it was only the wardrobe person who was like, "What's going on? Because your boobs are huge." I wasn't really showing in the belly yet. I was like, "I'm pregnant and I don't know what to do." Eventually, it was like, "You need to share it with them." Also, I was like, "I don't want to deny this beautiful life that's inside my tummy." I told Nina. I felt comfortable going to Nina because she was female and an executive producer. I told her first, and she was amazing. She was like, "Oh my God, that's amazing. Congratulations. That's perfect. Now we don't have to decide because we've been going back and forth with it. Cheryl or Kima, Kima or Cheryl. Now we know. It's Cheryl. I'm so glad you made our lives easy. We don't have to put a belly on you. We can just use your belly." She actually said, "I wish you'd have told us earlier because I don't think I told them until we were shooting the fifth episode or something. We could have shown the gradual increase of the belly." Then the beautiful thing that happened is that Elijah, my son, ended up playing our son on the show.
Robert Wisdom, Howard Bunny Colvin.
When Bunny gets introduced at the end of the second season, I was down doing that movie Ray in New Orleans, and my manager got the call that David Simon and The Wire were offering a role. I had no idea what that role was, but I had gotten caught back up. I admit that after not getting the Stringer Bell role, I said, "Fuck that show." But I came into it maybe after the third or fourth episode, and I was a fan of it. They offered this role, and we took it. And then I looked at it, and there were very few words to the character. Not too many tip-offs about who this guy was or what the scale of the role was. We had no idea about anything. I would go to these various locations. There was the murder of this kid in a drive-by shooting. And it was just going to these different sites of collateral damage that was happening in the hood. Because of the violence and the drugs and everything that was out of control, I just stood looking at these scenes. David came in early in the day and just laid out kind of generally what would be happening. When I look back on it, the whole skeleton, it laid out beautifully. The skeleton of Bunny's arc, and Bunny's story in just that one episode.
Michael Potts, Brother Muzon.
Brother Muzon was somebody that they had tried to cast for a while. I know my then agents were trying to get me in for it, but Alexa didn't see me for that role. I didn't come in to read for it until very late in the game, and I think I had a very persistent agent who kept saying, "Alexa, see him. See him. He can do this. Let him read for this." I came in basically when they had pretty much given up on finding the actor for the role, and that first episode that came in, I had just one line, just one word, just "officer." And that was supposed to be it. He wasn't supposed to come back after that. That's as much as they thought. They didn't think they'd be able to cast the role, or it wouldn't work as they had envisioned it.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
I knew a guy. His father was a preacher, and he was very articulate. He got involved with a spin-off of the Panthers, and he started robbing federal guards to get their equipment, which is not the brightest thing in the world. He got caught, but when I was talking to him, he was very focused. Revolutionary-type ideas, very firm, and I thought, maybe you can take that attitude, that strength, and take the discipline of one of Louis Farrakhan's people and mold them into this guy, and then find an actor who could play that part. And we did.
Michael Potts, Brother Muzon.
All I was thinking in my head, if I can get 3 episodes, I can catch up. I can get all my bills paid, and I can be even for the year again. They gave me one word in the very first, and in the second episode, they gave me a monologue. Method Man said, "They bringing you in nice."
Method Man, Calvin Cheese Wagstaff.
When auditions went out for the first season of The Wire, I made a conscious choice whether to go audition for that show or do the job that I was doing at the time, which was Brown Sugar, that Sanaa Lathan movie. I stuck around to do that. It turns out that shit didn't even make the movie. It hit the cutting room floor. They put it in the extras on the DVD. That's the only way you'll know that I was even in the damn movie. But yeah, I blew my shot there, because me and Hassan, who played Weebe, was there at the same time. He didn't like how they were utilizing him at Brown Sugar, so he kind of stormed off of the set, left, and did the Wire audition and got it. So, I watched the first season, and I wanted to get on the show when the casting call went back out for it. I went in and read for Alexa Fogel, and it went pretty well because I had read for Alexa before, so I was comfortable. I had read for her for Oz before, and I got the part. So when I went back to read for The Wire, I remember being comfortable. I remember the audition going well. I thought it could have been better, but when I walked out, I remember seeing Mr. Cheeks, and I was like, "Oh, shit, this part must be for a rapper or some shit." So I kind of was turned off by it for a second. But then, when I heard I got the part, I was excited. And first day on the set, I guess they were expecting some big entourage or something like that. But once they saw I was regular and accessible, it ran pretty smooth after that.
Ed Burns, co-creator.
You talk about a hero in the neighborhood, holy smokes. And all my kids in school, all their notebooks had that Wu-Tang Clan symbol. It was remarkable. You would have thought he was the second coming when he showed up.
Vincent Peranio, production designer.
Baltimore, despite what many people think, it's an extremely friendly place. The people are not jaded. They let you come into their house. Baltimore's interested that somebody's interested in them. Having the film about them and their neighborhood that nobody else cares about really picked up the attitude in the neighborhoods. They were excited about it. They didn't try to disrupt us or play loud music.
Method Man, Calvin Cheese Wagstaff.
Fans were a little rambunctious. Like in between shots, I would have to either stay inside if we were shooting inside, or go inside my trailer when people left. Because I would basically be signing autographs every time we yelled, cut. So yeah, it was a little crazy. They shot on location in Baltimore. So some of those streets they shot on were in real rough neighborhoods. One day, this family, they were just playing this music loud when we were trying to get our shot. And I remember the crew constantly asking if they could turn it down. And they was just beefing, like, we ain't doing shit. We live here. We ain't gotta do shit. So I walk over there, and I ask them politely, but I didn't ask them at first. First, I started kicking it with them. Yo, what's up, Method Man? Blah, blah, blah. What's good? What's good? This, that, and the third. Then I politely asked them if they could turn the music off while we get our shots off and shit. They were like, yeah, we'll do that for you. But don't get me wrong. They had goons on the set that would shut anybody down that would try and cause problems on the set. It just so happened that that day, I kind of stepped up and did it in a diplomatic manner, but nobody was offended.
Steve Schill, director.
The biggest dilemma for me as a white British man trying to interact with Method Man, I was like, what do I call him? Do I call him Mr. Man, Method, or Method Man? This is a guy who's already a giant star. I'm like, I'm going to show this guy the respect that he deserves, but as an Englishman, I need to find the right way to meet him at the correct level. But he didn't need direction. The scenes that I did with him, the only thing you need to tell him is, I think you come in here. You meet this guy here, you set your car on fire over there. That's all he needed to know. He did all the rest.
The Wire carefully picked moments to unravel the myth of Omar and his beliefs. One opportune moment presents itself in the season 2 episode, All Prologue. On the witness stand, Omar identifies Marquise Byrd Hilton as the killer of a state witness, William Gant. The writing made clear that Byrd had likely murdered Gant, and that Omar was not present at the time of the killing. Upon cross-examination, Byrd's lawyer, Maurice Levy, describes Omar as a parasite who leeches off the culture of drugs. Just like you, man, Omar interrupts. I got the shotgun, you got the briefcase. It's all in the game, though, right? The moment is one of the few times in the series that Levy, played by Michael Kostroff, the brother of Nina Noble, is flustered. Kostroff said he appreciated the scene and the ability to show another side of Levy, often remembered as conforming to Jewish stereotypes. If we only told stories where people didn't fall into different stereotypes, it would be really false, so I had no problem playing what some may call a Jewish stereotype, Kostroff said. I do believe that there are corrupt, successful Jewish lawyers. Rhonda Perlman is also a Jewish character, and she's on the side of good. I think people noticed it more because Deidre Lovejoy doesn't appear to be Jewish. So I think people don't notice the fact that there's two Jewish characters on both sides of the law. But I think we've gotten a little bit too careful about telling those stories. The Wire showed us black drug dealers and black elected officials, and good guys and bad guys, and thank God for that range. But if we objected to the portrayal of black drug dealers, we wouldn't have that show. Michael Kostroff, Maurice Maury Levy.
A lot of these actors I just found intimidating. But right before Michael K. Williams and I shot that courtroom scene, we had a good laugh because I was scared of him and he was scared of me because we'd only seen each other on the show. And he's the sweetest guy in the world, but I didn't know that. And he thought I was very mean and tough. So I took a deep breath and I walked over to him and I said, hi, I'm Michael Kostroff. He goes, I was scared to meet you. I said, I was scared to meet you too.
Michael K. Williams, Omar Little.
I was intimidated. There was a lot of people I respected. He was one of them. He had done stuff on Law and Order and was out and about. I was like, that guy? Holy shit. He was in my living room. My living room just 2 weeks ago.